Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Danny Dorling.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Can you shout at the back if you can't hear me? That never makes any sense.
No, it doesn't.
No. Okay. Thanks ever so much for coming. You're probably wondering what you're about to get. What you're not going to get is Jacqueline Haig. You're in the wrong place if you, this is 8:30 tonight, if you're expecting to get a receptionist who used to work in a tantric massage parlour. But she's on next after me. I've got discounted tickets for her. So if you're disappointed, don't worry. This is the blurb, and it says there's going to be swearing. And I don't normally swear, but I kind of feel obliged now, so I'll try and swear. You can tell me off if I don't swear enough. It's all about Brexit, it's about empire. I know it's very serious, so I don't want to upset anybody by you thinking I'm not taking this seriously. Me and my friend Sally wrote a whole book about it. It took us 2 years, so we do take this seriously, but you do have to laugh, I think. Particularly at this point where we are now, which is a point you might never have imagined us getting to. I'm going to show you what's in our book, and then in a very weird academic way, I'm going to concentrate on just one part of it, and then I'll come out and say what I think is going to happen next. There's going to be time for questions, so please think of a question. I always stick a new slide in. This is today's new slide. You might be able to remember a time, I can, when the BBC didn't put up really annoying graphics, which just showed you three numbers with some kind of 3D charts. But I've faked up a BBC graphic for you. This is the local election results. These are the three parties who lost seats. The Tories lost 1,330 seats. UKIP, happy days. UKIP lost 145. Yay, better. And Labour lost 84. And the BBC's verdict was, the voters have delivered a stinging rebuke to the two main parties. I am going to talk about numeracy. I should tell you who I am. I'm a university lecturer. I grew up in Oxford. I then moved to Newcastle. I spent 10 years living in Newcastle, which is why I know how to say Newcastle. I then lived for a little bit in Bristol. I then went up to Leeds 3 years, then 10 years in Sheffield, and then I'm now back down in Oxford. And a lot of this is going to be geographical, because I think the most interesting thing about Brexit and what's happening is the geography and why we don't get the geography. And you may have some answers for me, but soon when I've got too many slides. This, I've done just about 100 of these talks, so I might be slightly burnt out. I began by going to leave areas. I went to Hull and to Stoke and to Weston and all over the place. And what I discovered about leave areas is that the train connections are really, really, really bad. And getting home on the last train is simply dangerous. I also discovered that if you travel through London very late at night on the trains, they close the mainline stations to stop the homeless sleeping in them. Anyway, I learned a lot. The final thing I discovered by going to talk in leave areas is that the only people who turn up are Remainers. There are Remainers, of course, everywhere. This is a slide from a couple of weeks ago in Hampshire, where to try to get people to turn up in Hampshire, I tried to explain that we left the EU because of Hampshire. And I'm giving away the kind of punchline, but I actually believe it. So you're not going to get a normal kind of tale on this. Here's the book. I will shamelessly be selling the book at the end. £8, I've got change. It's very, very thick. I'm going to quickly go through what's in the book. Sally Tomlinson, my co-author, just stood for the Labour Party in her village of Broadway in the Cotswolds. Possibly the most expensive village in the Cotswolds. She got, I think, 159 votes. Yeah, well done, Sally. So she's going to have a party for 159 new friends. Sally is an expert on education and curricula. She was a primary school teacher in Wolverhampton at a time when Enoch Powell gave his speeches to children who were from all different kinds of backgrounds. She's disliked Enoch Powell ever since then. So we have a little bit about Enoch. This is the kind of thing that's in the book. Apologies if you are not young with amazing eyesight and sitting in the front. You're just going to have to believe me about some of these slides, but I'll zoom through. We have a list of all the biggest donors to political parties and the wide variety of parties that they tend to donate money to. The fun thing here, the book is published by Biteback. We were a bit late. We actually were turned down the first time we wrote a book because 300 people wrote books on Brexit immediately after the vote. The first 12 were all men who had a degree from Oxford or Cambridge. Hardly any of them were women, but 300 people wrote books on Brexit. The publisher who asked us to write the book decided they didn't like our book. We then took this book around many different publishers, over 20, and only one publisher would publish it, which is a publisher called Biteback, which is owned by Lord Ashcroft. Yeah. Lord Ashcroft, if you don't know, was the treasurer of the Conservative Party. The great thing about being published by Lord Ashcroft is he cannot sue us for what we've written in the book. There are 10 pages on Lord Ashcroft. He doesn't check his own books. We have photographs like this. This is our brave men of Border Force, stopping women, children, and somewhat desperate men going on rubber dinghies across to Lesbos. We have pictures from 1901. Daily Express, if you thought any of this kind of thing was new, of course it isn't. The Daily Express in 1901, with a cartoon of John Bull, illustrating an article entitled "The Pauper Foreigner, How the Government Had Been Frustrated in Their Efforts to Check Alien Immigration," by one Arnold White. The terrible pauper foreigners coming in then. We got the first Aliens Act, I think, in 1905, and the British Union of Fascists began then. The terrible aliens were Jewish. Those were the ones from Eastern Europe. These are the kind of images that were produced back then at the time. At the bottom it says, "Britannia, I can no longer offer shelter to fugitives. England is not a free country for you anymore." We have a long history of getting worked up about immigrants, and a key thing about Brexit was getting worked up about immigrants. We can argue it later, I'm not going to bother because I think it's obvious and I'd be insulting your intelligence if I made the case much more than that. But there's more to it, because people in lots of countries are bothered about immigrants, but there are 28 countries in the EU, and the fundamental question is, why us? Out of all 28, why was it us? Why couldn't it have been Greece who tried, or Italy, or Hungary? You'd expect it to be one of the little countries. You wouldn't expect it to be one of the big ones. Why us out of 28? What was different about us? Now, there are a couple of clues we can guess. One place did leave the European community before Britain left. That place spent 3 years negotiating and made a good deal. So it's possible. That place was Greenland. Greenland has 56,000 people, so they cared about them. They negotiated for 3 years. The EU still allows people from Greenland to come work and live in the EU because they can get Danish citizenship and do it that way. The EU still sends €500 per year per child to help fund the education in Greenland. What does the EU get back in return? Fish. This is one thing we've learned, and I'll come on to it at the end. Nobody realised how weak our bargaining position was. I mean, Brexit has been an education. My personal view, is that so far, what has happened is about as good as it could get. Now, suppose it had gone the other way round. 52% remain, 48% leave. What do you think would have happened then? And I'll leave that with you and we'll get on to it later. Or even 60% remain, 40% leave. I think what's happened so far is potentially very, very good for this country, depending on what happens next. The empire. One thing that makes us different from all the other EU 28 countries is that although some of them had empires, you can take all their empires and put them together and they're not a scratch on our empire. We had the biggest empire the world has ever known. We were bloody good at it. Really good. After those 13 colonies in North America, through their terrorist acts, escaped from our control, we got really tough and really good at it. And we did very, very, very well out of it. So well that we actually told ourselves that it was a burden and we weren't doing well, and it was a great gift that we gave to the rest of the world. And we believed ourselves. And then, when the colonies gained independence, because we gave it them, that isn't true, when the colonies gained independence, relatively, our economy sank and sank and sank. And we never said, oh, the reason why the mother country is going downhill is because we're no longer getting the profit from the unfair terms of trade that we instigated over a fifth of the world. We told ourselves it was those bloody trade unionists going on strike, or it was socialists, or it was some other kind of British disease, or it was not being a member of the European community. And so we begged them. We asked many, many times, please can we join? And they said no many, many times. And then finally we got to join. And then Mrs. Thatcher put on her multicoloured jumper and campaigned along with Labour and everybody else for a referendum after the event, just to confirm how happy we were that we could join, because we're so entrepreneurial and so clever that we knew that the minute we joined the European community, we would regain our rightful place at the top of the world. But we didn't. And so, well, that must be the fault of more trade unionists and more strikes and more socialists, and the feminists came along, and of course immigrants. All the way through this, immigrants have been part of the problem. But now, only if you set us free from the EU can we rise again, take back control, and be country number one. How on earth do you get that kind of thinking unless your entire education system is set up and formed to be extremely efficient to produce people to run an empire? That's what you need public schools for. That's what you need fagging for. A bit of beating, a bit of brutality, stiff upper lip, knowing how to give orders. Then you need another tier of people beneath them. Say let's have grammar schools. Another tier who can take orders but also know how to look down on those beneath them. Laird and Laird and Laird, know your place, keep a class system going. It's a bloody good way to run an empire. If you want to control the Khyber Pass with 12 men, that's the kind of attitude you need. It just doesn't work very well when you don't have an empire to control anymore. My friend Sally, who I wrote this book with, has looked through the textbooks of everybody who's still alive today. She's read the textbooks that Boris Johnson had in his prep school. I forget the name, she can memorize all these schools. His textbook in his prep school contained the word Piccaninnies and watermelon smile. He didn't get it from nowhere. None of them did. None of us do. We have grown up in a country that is imbued. I am the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography. Halford's established a geography department at Oxford to train young men to run the colonies with the skills that they would need. Why do you think you did geography at school? Why did you need to learn about mountains and rivers and what causes a flood and how cities work and where tin comes from and rubber comes from and iron comes from and how you need to move it around the world and trade? Geography was the subject of running an empire. Luckily for us, we were going really downhill in the 1970s. Geography was about to be taken out of the classroom curriculum. The university departments were all going to be closed, like they closed the anthropology department, which is also an empire subject. And then really lucky for geographers, somebody noticed that a glacier had stopped coming down and it was going back up again. And my subject was saved, anyway. Bad news for the planet, good for us. Pictures, here's Enoch Power, I promised you a bit of Enoch. Here's the preface of the book by Joseph Kelly, a lovely artist, trying to give an image of what the kind of ruins of the country feel like. We're in Brighton. It's all okay here, or wish okay here. You don't have to walk very far away from the middle for it to be a bit different. So I won't tell you what I saw this morning at the front, but you don't have to go that far along the coast in either direction to find not okay. And that's down here on the south. You go elsewhere, things are falling about a bit more. Enoch wanted to be Viceroy of India. He ended up, I think, being a Unionist MP in Northern Ireland. We laugh at ourselves. This is a cartoon Steve Bell drew about the Bull in the Club boys, who were the ones who ended up suggesting that you stick in a manifesto a promise that you will have a referendum. Remember, the confidence that is instilled at the very beginning to allow you to run entire countries without needing to check with anybody else what you're doing, that kind of thing. Here she is when she was happy. I do feel sorry for her. I do, anyway. I suppose I have to. She was one of our students at Oxford at the geography department. It's partly our fault. And you can look back at what we were teaching our students in the 1970s, late 1970s, and maybe it was our fault. What kind of environment it was to be there. She's opening her fate here. I've got a picture of her looking upset, but I decided not to show it. There are amazing geography connections to all of this. Not only is she a geographer, Jeremy Corbyn's first job in Jamaica was to be a geography teacher. Was he trained? Did he know anything about geography? No. He turned up as a volunteer in Jamaica and somebody said, we need somebody to teach geography. And this is a colonial thing. Rather than Jeremy going, I'm sorry, I don't know what I'm doing, he's British. He went, I'll try and do that. You know. Nasty things. Operation Vacon. Sending vans around people's homes, putting leaflets in shops in London, telling people they're not wanted. It's racist. Don't you know, no doubt about all that. Here's a picture of a little lad near the Elephant and Castle looking at posters. I love people who put these posters up on bus stations illegally, telling children not to fill in the school census because the school census could be used to deport them in future. And they actually managed to get the questions taken out of the census so that that information couldn't be collected that would allow children in this country to be deported. We're not that far from 1901-1905. And here's the old NF. I can remember the NF from my childhood, the National Front. These lots are up, if you recognise the metro stop, they're up in Newcastle. They're still there. They're there in different forms. I mean, a few of them are still diehard and actually NF. But they're there in different forms. They're there in some of our political parties. I can't help thinking that those same skinheads who kicked my head in when I was 14, who were only about 17, are now the 54-year-old men with a gut like mine and still no hair, but not because they've shaved it off anymore, who really, really believe that we need to send them back where they came from. I think it's the same kind of thing. And then this lot. This is Theresa May's first cabinet. We spend an entire chapter of the book, I think it's chapter 6, and it's the biggest chapter, going through each of them, listing their backgrounds, and then the biggest faux pas they've made in their lives. ordering their secretary to buy a sex toy. I won't go through the rest. The list is unbelievable. I would challenge you to come up with any cabinet. And we also take all the other ministers, because of course they were sacked and replaced at an incredible rate. I don't think there's ever been any other cabinet in British history quite as unbelievably inept as this lot. The book went through the lawyers, and the lawyers took none of it out because these are all well-known things about them. But shockingly bad. How did we get to the point of not having a competent Conservative cabinet? I mean, it really is quite amazing when you see it and go through it. Almost at the end. Well, at the end about trying to study the book. We wrote to Matthew Elliott asking for a picture. And lovely man, he sends us one back signed so we can stick it in the book. Matthew Elliott was the CEO of Vote Leave. And you've got to ask, why does a relatively young man want to do this? What was the motive? Everybody wants to know about the motives of these things. It's impossible to know people's actual motives, and they vary dramatically. I have a lot more sympathy for leavers having gone around the country and talked about this than I did at the beginning. And people do have different reasons, and it's not always racism. For older people, it's often simply wanting a future for their grandchildren and seeing no future now. And that's older Tories. Older Tories who've managed to get a £300,000 three-bed semi, whose children are renting in London and can't envisage managing to get onto shared ownership, and whose grandchildren are facing £56,000 debts for the privilege of going to university. And they just want something better for their grandchildren. They know they aren't going to get it. But that's not Matthew Elliott. That's not what Matthew Elliott actually wanted. The map, in case you're wondering, is Freddie Heineken's map of the future of Europe. In 1992, the beer magnate produced a map suggesting that the large countries of Europe would split apart. He had two historians guiding him, so it wasn't completely fanciful. And it may sound silly, but he got Yugoslavia spot on. Was not just that Yugoslavia was split up, he actually got the boundaries of what the states that would later form would be. And hence this is Freddie Heineken's prediction for the UK. And a few years ago, before Brexit, you'd have said a united Ireland was impossible. But there's nothing that's pushed on the chance even higher. All educated us that there is no border. There is no border. You cannot put a yoghurt pot on that none border. We didn't know. We didn't know the agreement that we'd actually signed. Or Scotland going. My favourite, Dominic Cummings. He's not Benedict Cumberbatch. He was played by him. The campaign director of Vote Leave, alumni of Exeter College, Oxford, established 1315, and the Durham School, established 1414. What drove Dominic? What drives Dominic? I'm a geographer. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. But I find this fascinating. I am sure he didn't think they were going to win, because he's not stupid. If you had thought you were going to win the referendum, you would have covered your tracks. You wouldn't have done things that later could have been found to be illegal. I'm sure that Boris Johnson didn't think they're going to win. You could look at Boris's face the day after, or Michael Gove's face the day after, to see the deep sense of upset. It wasn't the plan. The plan was that this was to be the first referendum. This was to show that they were heroes of the people. And then you get an actual plan in place of what you're going to do, and then you push and you get your second referendum after you talk about the terrible effects of BBC bias, because it's all remain of the church, the TUC, the CBI, all the political parties, not a really fair vote, and still you got, say, 45%. That was the plan. This wasn't the plan. That's why it's so good, 52-48. Because the alternative would have been awful. The alternative, a narrow Remain win, immigrants would have carried on being blamed for everything. Why is your school crap? It must be the immigrants. Why are babies dying in the hospital? That'll be the immigrants. Why can't you get a house? Why are your children having to hope they can do shared ownership? Why have your grandchildren got no chance even of renting somewhere where there's a good job? It'll be the immigrants. If you looked at the anti-immigration stuff before the referendum, imagine how that would have carried on afterwards. This is why I campaigned for Remain. I'm happy with this. I think it's called the bluff. If anybody can tell me where Dominic Cummings is now, I'd love to know. He did spend 3 years in Russia, but I do not believe these kind of conspiracy theories. That I think he generally spent 3 years in Russia failing to set up an airline. But I'd love to know where Dominic is now. On to the vote. Explanations for the vote. Lisa, anybody laughing's got good eyesight. Now, what academics normally do when we're talking about elections is we do what we did last time there's an election, and we tell you the same things: the economy's really important, how good they might be as a leader matters. And then we vary the story ever so slightly, and we stroke our chin, and if you're Professor Sir John Curtis, you fall off your chair. I saw him do that 20 years ago. He was so excited about one election that he did. And you look really authoritative, as if you know what's going on. Now, what's fascinating about Brexit is that we didn't have a precursor. So all those academics immediately got out the numbers, produced computer models, and wrote papers all at the same time explaining what had happened. And the brilliant thing is that the answers vary. Now, I will have got things wrong, but the thing I know for true is that most of my colleagues have to as well, because we no longer did the same explanation. This was one of the kind of, in a way, you could see why the researcher who produced this was really excited, if you're an academic. 3 weeks after the result, each little dot is a local authority district. On one side of the graph, you've got the proportion of people voting leave, and on the other, you've got the proportion who are overweight, or I think on one side obese. If you're wondering what the difference between overweight and obese is, by the time I finish this beer, I will be obese. If I'm really good tonight and don't eat that much, I will just tip into overweight. That's the kind of difference. Point eight correlation. And the researcher who produced that said, and the problem was it was reported in the Sun and the Express and the Daily Star, and I don't think he went into hiding, but it was close to that. He said, people who are fatter are more feckless and don't think ahead. Unlike Remainers, who are really careful, and you can tell they're careful because they're thinner. And so on. This is an ecological correlation. It doesn't actually mean that fatter people actually vote one way or the other. What it means is that areas with more people who are fat have more people voting leave. Now, I'll give you a clue because I've got to speed up. The second highest correlation, 0.79, is with migration. Now, most of the migrants, by which I mean people from overseas, most of the migrants didn't get a vote. Migrants, you might have noticed this, how many of you were born outside the UK? So I get an idea. Okay, we're going to look on the average, but migrants tend to be a bit annoyingly fit, thin, cocky, overqualified.
I'm sorry.
I know.
tend to swear.
You're adding, that's variation, you see. Well, you're making me feel good. We're there together. Migrants are thinner. The areas to which migrants come, like London and Brighton, collect a set of people who are thinner. They're healthy, it's called the healthy migrant effect. Areas to which migrants don't go, think Blaenau Ffestiniog, think Doncaster until recently. There are no thin migrants, so the average is higher. But it's bigger than that. I now live back in Oxford. Every October, all these really skinny people turn up. The only reason we hold interviews for students is just not to let the fat ones in. It's called unconscious bias. Anyway, what happens in areas where lots of people are thin is that you start to get self-conscious and you eat less and you diet because the norm around you is thinner. In other areas, let's call them Essex, where people are fatter, you don't feel you're fat because everybody else is the same kind of size. Anyway, I won't go on about it. There's nothing in the actual obesity thing. What's really interesting is all the other things that obesity tracks, which probably are more related to the result. Just giving you a correlation of 0.8. This is a correlation of 0.03. That's as near to nothing as you can get. And that's the relationship between voting leave and deprivation. Now, the thing you're likely to think, as soon as I tell you there's no relationship with deprivation, is you'll think about Brighton or London, and you'll think, oh, but the poorer parts of Brighton, that bit up near the Downs, you know, where the bus service isn't very good. They voted leave more there, didn't they? Nobody near me did. Or in London, it's the poor part of London. And you'd be right. But you go to Devon, or you go to Hampshire, and it's the richer parts that actually voted leave. Not Winchester, but the richer parts with the old retirees who can afford to move and retire somewhere like Devon. And it has to be, because nationally, all those areas cancel out with all the places like London and Brighton to get an overall relationship, which is 0.03. Age above all was the best and simplest predictor from the surveys. 70% of the young didn't vote. If you ask them now, they say they did. And they're not lying. Who here didn't vote? Come on. Ray, brilliant.
I was not allowed.
Not allowed. Who was allowed didn't vote? Okay. Go on, be brave. There must be one. 30% of people didn't vote. It's a hard thing to do. There will be at least one, if not two or three people in this room didn't vote. However, you do not know you didn't vote. If we ask people how you voted in the referendum now, 90% of them tell us they voted. 90%. And it's not lying. We live our entire lives by reconstructing our histories. The best evidence for this is elections. When you go to vote in an election or the referendum, you remember somebody getting out a ruler and crossing your name off on a bit of paper? That's a public document. Right? We get those. They're destroyed about 3 months later, but we can get access to them. Because you're allowed to check who voted and who didn't. And when we do an election survey, we ask people, did you vote? And then we ask loads of things about how they voted and why. And then we check with a line on the ruler. So we know what proportion of people. And it's not that they're lying. You wouldn't construct all this. They might be a bit ashamed. But we all reconstruct memories. And this is going to make understanding Brexit really difficult in future. Because you do, this is, we were all, most of us, unless, apologies if you get depressed about life, in which case you reconstruct the memories the other way around, but most of us remember ourselves as being quite popular, friendly, and those relationships that ended, well, it wasn't really my fault, it was hers or his. You know, that's how you get through life as a human being. Age is the main thing. The map, if you are able to see it, is the 2014 map of voting in European elections. The purple is UKIP, and that is an age distribution right round England, away from where the centres of employment are. This little spiral graph is just about the support for the far right. You don't have to understand it, you just have to believe me. This is far, far right. I mean, UKIP, Referendum Party, National Front, British National Party, that kind of thing. Got up to a high of 14% in 2014. Always collapses between European elections. There isn't a slow, steady rise of fascism in this country. There's lots of good news. But boy, can you whip up people if you want to. And the reason it spirals is because they're whipped up again and again and again before each European election by certain parts of the press, by people wanting something which they finally got. This little graph here, apologies to you people on this side, I've kind of ruined, you just have to really believe me. This is the proportion of people voting what I would define as far right at each European election we've ever had. The first was 1979. Amazingly, the National Front put up no candidates, and there wasn't any other far right party, so nobody voted far right. In 1984, nobody voted far right. In 1989, it slipped off. We should say 0.1% of people voted for parties like National Front. By 1994, after Jimmy Goldsmith had done his referendum party and sent everybody of my age a VHS cassette, 1.1%. 1999, 7.5%. 2004, once UKIP are doing well, 20%. Now, only a third of people normally vote in European election, but 20%. 2009, the Conservatives leave the EPP. The EPP is the main huge Tory bloc in the European Parliament. They left them. I've given half their votes, we've got 37%. 2014, the Conservatives form an alliance in Europe with a group of fascists, including Alternative for Deutschland, who are neo-Nazis, and one nutter from Finland and one from Sweden and so on. 2014. We sent 40-odd far-right and extreme-right MEPs to the European Parliament. The far-right, and the definition's really simple, to the right of the mainstream European Conservatives is far-right. There are Conservatives. The extreme right, which is a group in Europe which is even more to the right than that group, is where UKIP sit. And those 40-odd MEPs are by far the largest far-right bloc in the European Parliament. We are the rising right of Europe. It's not Golden Dawn in Greece, it's not the Free Finns. It's not those odd ones down in Spain who managed to get a few votes at the last election, but not much. It's us. And without Brexit, we would not have realised it. We still don't largely realise it. You think, those Conservatives are really very nice. They're just a bit old-fashioned. Look at Operation Bacon. Look at people being sent to die in Jamaica. It's not pleasant. Look at how many refugees we actually took. Look how we treated the man who was a kinder transport himself when he thought he'd made a deal to get some children in. Look at the language they use. So by the 2014 European election, 52.9% of people who voted in Britain voted for a far-right European party, mainly the Conservatives and UKIP. I wish I'd realised it. I mean, I'm enough of an egotist and a narcissist to think if I'd written the academic paper saying, look, 52% of people have done this, it's going to tell us something is odd. When you move far right, it happens without you noticing. It's just a new norm, it's a new kind of angry. Things have got bad. There's some group to blame. In Germany it was 1%, according to the 1933 census. They were Jewish, but it was their fault. It's always somebody else's fault. And politicians come up saying that they will look after you and make things great again. And it's very sad to say this, but this is, it's easier to say this now when we have a Brexit party and we have them zooming up in the polls in 1 week to where they did. Some geography. This is a map of Europe. It's stretched so that people get an equal amount of space. I've not got enough time, so apologies if it's really weird. It should be weird. Who has ever seen a map like this before? Right, a few of you, apologies to the rest. If you could understand this, you're a genius. Stretch map, area proportional to population. The areas which are yellow less than 1 in 20 people are born abroad. The areas which are dark blue, more than a fifth. Medium blue, between those two. The mainland of Europe is full of migrants because it's really, really easy to be born on the Dutch border with Germany and get a boyfriend or girlfriend 2 miles on the other side. And then if you want to carry on living in the same house, one of you's got to be a migrant. Switzerland has the highest migrants. Fairly high in Paris, quite high in Madrid. Loads of migrants down the Costa del Sol. Yeah, you've worked out. I was looking forward to welcoming them back. Of course, the ones who had come, because, you know, think about it. You know, you've got used to it, you know, you like having that kind of suntan that makes your skin crack. They'd only come back when they were ill and couldn't access the hospital. Anyway, here we are, that's London. And this is what I mean about a 0.79 correlation. Right, the more migrants, the more remain you are. Areas without migrants will more leave, except for Ireland. Ireland's absolutely chock full of migrants. People born in one European country living in another. Now there are a few people from Poland working in a meat packing factory in Belfast, but it's not them. These are people born on one side of that border, which is no longer a border and means nothing and you cannot put a yoghurt pot on it, who now live on the other side of that border, which is no longer a border. You know, if we fought, anyway, I won't go any further, but it's been an education. So that's the map of migration. That's David. There's the result. And here's the thing that may surprise you about itself. This is a train that used to run from Newport to Cleethorpes. And it's a train that ran along the traditional north-south divide. Traditional north-south divide goes from here to here. Okay? Most of the land to the south of that is blue. It's leave. You could do it that way. And most of the land to the south is leave. And this is where I'm going to introduce a really strange idea. You've got to bear with me, and then I'm going to zoom through really quickly so we've got enough time for questions and for you to tell me I'm a traitor. This is what I want to try and do. I want to create a new national walk. Right, you know the Pennine Way and John Groats to Land's End. This is the walk you have to do if you want to understand Brexit. So it begins in Cornwall, which is about 57% leave, goes through Devon, 55% leave, Dorset, 56%, Hampshire, 54%, hop over to the Isle of Wight, 61%, here to Sussex, 50.3%, and imagine what Sussex is if you were to take Brighton out, the rest of it, through to Kent, almost 60%, Essex, 62%, Suffolk, 57%, Norfolk, 57%, Cambridge, even Cambridge, 50.5%, Hertfordshire majority, Bedfordshire majority, Northampton majority, bang through the West Midlands, down through Gloucestershire, through Somerset, through Bristol, through Wiltshire, still in majority, Berkshire. Finally, you get to a minority, but not if you take out some parts. Oxfordshire, because of Oxford, Buckinghamshire, down to Surrey. Even Surrey was 47.8% leave. Through to London, 40%. Finally, to the City of London, which is only a quarter leave voting. Because boy are they pissed off. Yes. They had paid for the political party. It was their party. They owned it. They actually, I mean, you've got to feel sorry for them. Too many of these. I'll just do the first four or five and then you'll just have to believe me. If anybody doesn't believe me, I've got a handout for you because I'm a lecturer. Cornwall. 56.5% leave. That's 183,000 people who voted leave. Out of 421,554 who were allowed to. This stuff is exact. Everything else is based on surveys. I can tell you 59% of leave voters are middle class. Confidence interval, 58 to 60. Very large poll, thanks to Lord Ashcroft, who paid for an exit poll because he thought they were going to lose and wanted the evidence for the next one, right? Everything else is based on surveys. We can learn a lot from surveys, but this is exact. More people voted Leave in Cornwall than in Gedling, Nottingham, Ashfield and Broxtowe in the Nottinghamshire coalfield. And they had more people on the electoral roll in the coalfield. I was at a party on Saturday with somebody whose dad was a miner who did strike in Nottinghamshire. He was telling me it's all about the northern working class. And a little bit of it is, but not most of it. The majority of Leave voters were in the south of England, but the majority of the UK electorate isn't. Turnout is absolutely key. Leavers did vote in the north, but not as ferociously as Leavers in the south voted. Remainers didn't vote. That's the difference. Let's take Devon. 377,000 Leave voters, as opposed to less in Gateshead, plus Eden, plus South Lakeland, plus County Durham, Conway, Denbighshire, Flintshire. Remember, a lot of the north is small, but even taking into that into account, it's a lower portion of the electorate that votes. Dorset. More Leave voters in Dorset than Northumberland, North Tyneside and South Tyneside, and we're chucking Torfen, a very poor part of Wales. 60% Leave, low turnout, fewer Leave voters than Dorset. Hampshire. More Leave voters in Hampshire than all the Leave voters combined of the whole of Leeds, Blackpool, Sheffield, our fifth largest city, Merthyr, Derby and Great Yarmouth. Nobody has ever gone down to report about Leave from Hampshire. Higher proportion of the electorate voted Leave in Hampshire. Remember, they're old, predominantly former UKIP and Tory voters. Of course it's a southern thing. Which political party wanted it? Where are they based? Where does the European Research Group represent? I mean, it's Isle of Wight compared to Luton. It's not really in the north, but Sussex, more Leave voters here than East Lindsay. This is real Leave country. 71% Leave, 70% in North East Lincolnshire, 66% in North Lincolnshire. Doncaster, where Amber Valley is a little bit, well, 60%. Okay, I've chucked in Glasgow, Dundee and Aberdeen as well. It's big, high population, lots of old people, lots of Conservatives, lots of Leave votes. Might only have been a 50.3% majority, but it's stacking up the votes. That's the way it works. Mm-hmm. Kent. More Leave voters in Kent than Anglesey, Stoke, only 81,000, Chesterfield, Bradford, Preston, Salford, Sunderland, Hull. All put together. All those places that people go to talk about Leave are all trivial compared to a southern county. What happened on the night was that around about midnight, it went off script. The computer model started coming in. Remain was supposed to win. The spread betting said Remain was going to win. The spread betting hadn't got anything wrong. And then Joe gets stabbed to death by a man shouting Britain first. We just assume, well, we know what's going to happen. Remain are going to win. But it went wrong. And somebody hadn't written the other script in W1A. So they're sitting there, and the camera pans in on one blonde woman and two men with no hair in Sunderland, yelping, and the story's set. Because it's so much easier to blame people a long way away from you that you've never interacted with, if you're sitting in W1A in the BBC, than to blame your own mother and father in Hampshire, who you know voted Leave. And once it's set, I mean, it will break. This is why we have to have this walk. It's a kind of pilgrimage. It's a kind of long way to understand the future history books. Walking past the majority of Leavers' houses. And I'd like little plaques along the walk to talk about the North. And then, you know, sort of said, you know, there were people who voted Leave up there, you know, not as many, but we mustn't forget them. That, okay, you've probably had enough of this. I won't go through, I've got to do you Essex. Essex, 622 Leave voters. More than Lincoln, Rutland, Lyne, Gwent, and Carlisle, Allendale, Copeland, Craven, Lancaster, Barrow, Ribble, Pendle, Holborn, Blackburn, Rossendale, Rochdale, Knowsley, Redcar, Scarborough, Rydal and Selby all put together. And look, let's just leave it, shall we? I'm going through Warwickshire, West Midlands, there isn't enough time, you want to ask me questions. Gloucestershire, Somerset, but Bristol, a bit like here. 38% leave, quite low. Edinburgh, always a southern English place, has more leave voters. And I haven't fixed this. You can't fix it, it's like a giant jigsaw, right? And you can tell it annoys me because I just think it's bloody obvious. It's just adding up and taking away. There's no dividing. Nothing that hard. Wiltshire, more Leave voters in Wiltshire than all the Leave voters of Bridgend, Swansea, Bury, High Peak and Harper put together, who had more people on the electoral roll. Right? No reporting about the disgruntled of Wiltshire. There are good reasons to be disgruntled if you're in Wiltshire. Right? They've just lost their car factory in Swindon. Do you remember them saying that Germany would cave in because they sell 10% of their cars to us? You worked out how many cars Germany's going to have to sell us now, we're going to make even fewer here. But we'll have to buy the smaller ones. Some of those arguments were just, in hindsight, fatuous. I found it partly convincing at the time. The BMW factory in my city of Oxford produces a Mini every minute with about the same, let's not call it profit, but I don't know what other word there is, same excess take as the University of Oxford gets on an overseas postgraduate student. The University of Oxford produces an overseas postgraduate student every hour. Car factory produces a Mini every minute. It is 60% more productive than my university, and we could lose it. You could double the size of my university and you'd hardly make a blip on the export earnings. What's going on? Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire, London. Okay, the final challenge of this, that's the rest of London. The final challenge is the City of London. In every other case, I have found parts of the north, all different, never the same one, using every single bit of the north, with fewer Leave voters, with more electors than in the south. But I'm left with the City of London. Only a quarter of people in the city voted Leave. Where do I find outside of the southeast of England with fewer Leave voters? Any guesses?
Northern Ireland.
Not Northern Ireland, more Leave voters there because of the Protestants. Not Scotland, that's great, you're giving me nerd happiness feelings.
Gibraltar,
well done. There we go, that completes it. I was almost stuck until I remembered that for some reason we let them have a vote in Gibraltar. Only 4.1%. So without exception, everywhere in the south, you could even take Brighton, and I could find you somewhere outside which were the fewer Leave voters than Brighton without cheating in this particular game. There's the, if you really want to know, that's the explanation. It is much lower turnout in places like the northwest, Yorkshire, Humberside, the northeast. Yes, very low turnout in Scotland and London. They were complacent. But really high turnout, highest, in the southeast, the southwest, the eastern region, the East Midlands. And that's what tipped us over. It also tipped us into a situation where we cannot talk about this being something that was voted by the North, because it wasn't. Let's wrap up. We're going to stop in 5 minutes. We have got a mic, but it's so small you might be able to shout out. The British Empire, that's a particularly weird map of it. I think it's Gordon Brown who said, of the current 193 members of the United Nations, we are the only country who at one point or another has invaded over 170 of them. Right? It's unique as an experience. India, of course, is bigger and more important. If you want a sense of the fall, it's a big fool saying this, but there was no official agreement on the succession of head of Commonwealth. If India was bothered, they would have demanded it had been somebody from India. The fact that Prince Charles will be head of the Commonwealth shows you how little India is bothered about the Commonwealth. The last colony was Hong Kong, depending on how you feel about Gibraltar. This is Chris Patton, Chancellor of my university, wiping away his daughter's tears as the sun sets on the empire and she cries because it's such a terrible time, because Britain did such a good job in Hong Kong, where we were invited into by grateful people who wanted us to be there. Not because we needed a staging post that we blew people out of the water to get, because we had to sell the opium that we were growing in India to the Chinese, so that they would buy the cotton that we were weaving in Manchester, that we were growing in the Americas, using the slaves that we were taking from Africa. Somebody had to have the world's biggest ever empire. It is a painful thing. With Sally, I've constructed a list of Indian famines, several of which 10 and 11 million people died in under us, which you can learn instead of learning the kings of England, if we really are going to have road history. Why was she crying? She wasn't crying because the sun was setting. She cried for 3 hours that day. She was crying because she had to leave her boyfriend, and nobody could tell her why. They could have left her. If you want one reason for buying the book, the full picture's in the book, and you can see the most gormless looking Prince Charles on the edge of that, with a look on his face that goes, what the hell do I do if a woman cries? We're strange. It's okay for us to be strange. We did weird things, or our grandparents and great-grandparents did. It would be strange if we were not strange. And not only did we do weird things, we never acknowledged we did, so we didn't learn from them, like other places have had to after they've committed those terrible acts, put it that way. Only one in six of us has ever been on demonstration. Even the Germans put us to shame. They're the next lowest nation in Europe, and they're twice as likely to demonstrate. If you want to know why the French get better child benefit for their third child, whereas we get none, you can just have a look at how it's done by watching what happens over there. Why don't we demonstrate? Well, we didn't really have to. We were the richest people on the planet. Even our working class was the richest working class on the planet. We could afford a welfare state, even after a war, not just because of the money that America was lending us, but we still have the legacy in the end of the empire. But you learn and you're taught at school how to behave and be polite, be civil. Demonstrating doesn't come naturally to a country when most people had it pretty good for 200 years. Here's the immigration chart over time, the Jewish immigration, the Windrush period, the Eastern European period. Here's the extra million who supposedly caused all the fuss. Here's what it looks like if you put the people born in Britain in. It's not so much, and as I showed you earlier, for the whole of Europe, it's actually normal. In fact, it's slightly low from the point of view of a European country. We do have a channel, which does make it a little bit harder. Farage is always pictured with a pint of Green King IPA. Always the same one. Why was it so hard to get a deal? Standard & Poor produced this analysis 3 weeks before the referendum over which other countries would be most affected if Britain was to leave. Most affected Ireland. They got that right. Although Dublin is actually booming. Then Malta, then Luxembourg, then Cyprus. What do you know about Malta, Luxembourg and Cyprus? They're small, yeah. It doesn't really matter, and they're not actually that affected. Then Switzerland, because we kind of have some banking relationships with them. Switzerland doesn't get a vote, because it's not in the EU. Then Belgium, right? Where's Germany? Where's France? Where's we weren't doing anything that they really valued. That's the shock. That's the shock. That's why we're in this situation. The banks have started to move. The middle tier bank, the Japanese banks, have moved their headquarters from London to either Amsterdam or Frankfurt or Paris. It's a bit of a shock for the bankers. They send the ones without children. Now, partly because bankers don't know what to do if there isn't a school that costs £30,000 a year for their kids. I've learned recently, we had 3,000 bankers earning over €1 million a year in London. 3,000. The next highest country was Germany with 197. Our bankers said that you had to pay them that much or they would go somewhere else and be paid more. Innumerate. We've been innumerate. Really. 2017 general election. Let's take you back slightly. Tony Blair, 1997, gets an 8.8% shift after 18 years of Conservative rule and some pretty crap opposition leaders, but not bad. He then loses 2.5% of the vote. He then loses 5.5% of the vote. That's not a good record. Gordon Brown comes in and loses a further 6.2% of the vote, admittedly after the biggest economic crash since 1929. Ed Miliband stands and gets a 1.4% shift. And that's really, really good. Compared to Gordon Brown and Tony Blair's track record, that was really good. The only problem is you've got to repeat it about 10 times, which is 50 years before you win. And then this weird man who can't speak, who hates all kind of people while he isn't sticking pins into dolls on his allotment or whatever else he's doing, gets 9.6%. And somebody goes, oh, but that's not a swing. I won't go to extreme nerdiness on this one, but if you really want to know about a massive swing, look at the local election results from a few days ago. And that's a massive swing. This is the change on these strange graphs. It was the biggest, fastest, most sudden change in behaviour of the people of Britain in what they thought in the months and weeks leading up to that election ever. Biggest ever. And now we've seen again biggest ever shifts in local elections. Anything can happen. The really good news, if you're on the left, is that the problem with getting one of these landslides is that you win. And the problem with winning, and it's the same problem that Leave had with winning, the problem with winning is you disappoint. Because you can never give people everything you promised them. And normally when Labour gets a landslide, they win. This time they get a landslide and don't win. Now you may think you're disappointed because you're not a normal set of people. You're out on a Sunday night listening to a strange university lecturer. Most people in Britain are not like you. They don't really give a toss about politics. They don't follow any of it. They don't know. Anything can happen from this point. That's what we've learned from 2017. And things are happening and shifting that we don't notice, because when they shift for all of us, I should have told you, you can go to the bar at any time. So if you want to get, I think that deserves a pint for the coughing person. So please do at any point. And if you're brave enough to go now, you get in before the rush. It's a bit like asking people if they didn't vote. It's incredibly English, isn't it? Not willing to embarrass ourselves. The worst thing that could happen would be a bit of embarrassment. Stiff upper lip. The reason that Stanley said, when he met him finally in the middle of Africa, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, those particular words, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, is because it wasn't done for one English gentleman to introduce himself to another. You should have been introduced by another party. Stanley was instructing his men to shoot the natives willy-nilly like birds. That was okay. But the danger of embarrassment is the utmost danger. Hence the ultimate word of disapproval in the English language is I was disappointed.
Yes.
We are an odd country, but we're changing. We are beginning to care when things happen in a way we didn't care. And we're beginning to notice differences, these differences in Kensington. We're beginning to notice this little red line is the cuts, this is the UK, this is around about 36% of GDP, this is the rest of Europe, this is Finland, this is France, this is Germany, this is Greece. Greece is doing much better than those in several ways. Life expectancy, amount of money they're putting into their schools. It doesn't come easily to learn this stuff. The mad extreme lefties in Finland who tax and spend 56% of GDP, their country hasn't fallen apart. When recession hits, they increase the tax rate because the country gets poorer, so you tax more so that the public services don't go down one iota. Right? And they even did that despite the fact they were losing Nokia at the same time because Apple was doing really well. Because it was a principle. Whereas what do we do when our GDP falls, and the biggest fall very close to since the Black Death? We're actually getting to the point when the only equivalent is actually the Black Death. What do? We actually cut the proportion of taxation that we take of a falling thing to get to 36%. We would have to spend an extra billion euros a week, not 350 million pounds, a billion euros a week if we wanted a German-style funded health service. You're thinking, where the hell do you get a billion euros a week from? Well, you don't play with nuclear submarines, that kind of thing, but also you just tax people normally. And then, when one of us suddenly feels something going wrong inside and it's all the worst thing that's ever happened to you, and you suddenly realise what really matters, which is your health and not being able to pay for the cruise holiday, you get treated. But we're not that clever. Labour want 38%, Tories 36%. We're playing in there. I'm afraid, and that's as good as it's going to get. The mad manifesto that Andrew Fisher wrote in 2017 would put us just below Spain and all the rest of Europe in terms of our public spending. It isn't revolutionary. It's great. It's the best thing that's ever happened in my life politically, but there's nothing that radical about it. Why? Because we became the economically most unequal country in Europe. The most unequal countries in the OECD, Mexico, Chile, Turkey, run by a dictator, United States, sort of dictator, Lithuania, forget about that, Russia, maybe a dictator, United Kingdom. May isn't a dictator, bless her. Then Israel. We tolerate a higher rate of income inequality, which is respect inequality, within inside the UK, than they tolerate in Israel, which includes the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in the statistics. That's the country we live in. That's why you walk past people in sleeping bags on the streets and look, oh, that's sad. You know, we don't vote to do something about it. It is a shameful kind of realisation, is Brexit, of what we actually are. I've been going on about numeracy, almost at the end, only one or two more slides. This is our maths results at age 24. We're down there with the United States. We teach people to get A stars. We don't teach them maths. It's a different thing. Final slide. It's not all depressing. This is just Europe at night. Across the continent, fascists are losing votes and support faster than they're gaining it. It's just that every time the far right goes down, it's not reported. It's always reported when they go up. Across the continent, they're facing the possibility that even if we do vote in the European elections, they might not have to cope with 40 of our far-right MEPs anymore, unless Farage does amazingly well, because perhaps 50 or 60% of people, for the first time ever, might vote in those European elections, including the 4 million people who were not allowed to vote in the EU referendum. If you want one thing to end on about why I'm hopeful, the nearest equivalent we have to what's just happened is the Suez Crisis, which was a moment of deep embarrassment in the 1950s. But shortly after the Suez Crisis, we got the 1960s, and one of our most progressive decades and biggest leap forward in social change ever, partly because the elite had shown that they couldn't run things. The elite have shown that they cannot run things now. The young are mobilised, almost 1,000 arrests in London. That beats anything that occurred in this country in 1968 by miles. There are loads of reasons to be optimistic. I'm going to stop there. We can do about 5 minutes of questions, and then I'll try and flog you a book. But please don't forget, 8:30, Jacqueline Hay, what I learned as a receptionist in a tantric massage parlour. Thank you very much. Who wants really quick questions? Well, I promise really quick answers. Over there.
Do you think your information was really interesting about that kind of north-south thing in the volume of people?
Yeah.
Is pretty much all the news journalists, the channels, are they lazy, sloppy journalists, or do they not know the data? Or why
don't
they send all the journalists to Stoke?
and the Prime Minister goes to Stoke.
Yeah.
Why don't they know? They got it wrong at the beginning and they copy each other. It's very hard if you get something wrong to admit you got it wrong. I find it hard. I kind of quietly forget the things I got wrong and don't mention them again.
But that's a huge thing.
It's a huge thing, yes. Yeah. You can find parts of the North with very high proportions of those who voted, not of the electorate, of those who voted and voted Leave. And you can easily go into a pub and ask people and you'll get from anywhere. But once the story's set, it's very hard to change it. The nearest equivalent I've seen is the Watts riots in Los Angeles, where immediately after a riot, and many hundreds of people died in those riots, the rioters are condemned, it was a terrible thing, there's no reason for it. 3 years after, shortly before he was shot, Martin Luther King gave a speech about why there really were those riots. And we now look back at American black inner city riots and we think differently. And I suspect with Brexit, it'll be in years to come that the story will be told differently. I'm just worried it'll take 20 years rather than 10 years to do that. Another question? Man there.
Yeah, following on from that, has this information gone to the Labour Party, for example? They're ignoring it as well. They've got a strategy which is out of sync with what you're telling us.
Yeah. A lot of people, I'm not a member of the Labour Party, I should say. I'm not a member of any party. I do, but my mother, my wife, and my daughter is. I do like them. But I like the Greens as well. But I don't like being told you've got to behave in a certain way and always be loyal. A lot of the Labour Party know this, particularly a lot of the candidates who are standing in places in the South. John Mann doesn't, and whether he'd be capable of understanding it, I don't know. But you probably saw the kind of heartfelt thing from the leader of Sunderland Council. They've still held it. If you talk to people on doorsteps, you don't get a representative view, right, of what most people think. You get the view of people who like talking on doorsteps. And then if you take that home, similarly, two others, if you take the view of people who come to your surgery as an MP as being what most people think, again, you get a very strange view. Or what posh people always do, which is report what their cab driver said about the world, as if, and then that's okay because the working class have been represented in the meeting. This is why you've just got to go back to the actual behaviour and events. to do it. A lot do know. £7 million was spent on the Remain campaign. Of that £7 million, £4 million was spent by Labour under the direction of Jeremy Corbyn with his approval. Jeremy is a man who should never lead anything. I think he's very nice. He is ridiculously honest. When he said 7 out of 10, he meant 7 out of 10. Not some conspiracy way he wants to leave. He's 7 out of 10 in favour. When Jon Snow asked him, would you like to be Prime Minister? And he didn't answer for 7 times. He was telling you something. He's not very good at lying. That's why he's not made a single claim on his expenses as an MP, not even for a black and white TV licence. Right? He's an odd bloke. But the idea that Jeremy Corbyn really wants to leave is just ridiculous when he sanctioned the spending of £4 million, quite hard-won pounds, out of the total £7 million that was spent by the Remain. Do you ever hear that the bulk of the spending to Remain was the Labour Party? When you hear how much the Liberals would like to stay, it's perfect tactics for the Liberals. You know, how else do you get, I mean, they do, I generally believe it, they really want to stay. But also, it's a brilliant way to get votes, as you saw in the local elections. Tories can very easily vote Liberal, right? It's just a slightly nicer, it's what left-wing Tories used to be. And it's, but actually, generally doing it is different. My view for 2 years has been we're going to revoke. And I could be wrong. I said anything can happen. Hard Brexit is still possible, in which case people will die. May's deal is possible, even though John McDonnell today said the trust had been lost as she leaked the negotiations. It's not impossible, given the way that politicians act, that they're secretly in talks right now, and they've done a brilliant bluff by looking like they've walked out of them. And we'll have some kind of customs union thing suddenly announced, and they can get 320 MPs to back it. But the reason why revoke is the most likely thing is not based on principle. It's just that we cannot leave. We cannot get enough Prozac into the country. If you go through the 65 documents, we can't keep the car factories working. The banks have entirely lost the trust in us. Even if we were to remain, the trust is gone. The banks have lost the trust in their Conservative Party, which has been taken over by their members. Isn't it funny that we always talk about Labour to be taken over by its members? But the party that's really been taken over by its members is the Conservative Party, to the detriment of the finance industry of the country. So I must be short. Go on, who else? Let's go right to the back. Yes, you.
Isn't there a danger? You're taking a snapshot of the night of the referendum, or the day of the referendum.
Yeah.
And then you haven't quite said it, but leaving an impression that those people who didn't vote in the North would have somehow voted Remain.
Yes.
You're creating a false optimism on that.
Yes, that's a fair comment. I mean, the one thing we know several things about them. We know they were generally younger. And we know in general that younger people voted Remain. It is entirely possible that younger people in the North wouldn't, except they did in Manchester and Liverpool. It wasn't just students. We'll never know. We'll never know. What's your low ass? All we can know for sure is exactly who voted where and what they voted. We'll never know people's internal reasoning. We can guess, which is why I'm happy to say there was a lot of racism around. But trying to guess what people who didn't vote would have done had they voted, I agree it would be useful to know. The problem is that the standard question I could ask all of you, which is, how would you vote if there's a general election tomorrow? The actual answer you give is how you would have voted had there been a general election 6 weeks ago. Sounds very odd, but there's a brilliant correlation between the responses to polls and actual voting in the past. Because there's a little change. Most of you are probably dead set. How many, I'm not going to ask you to vote. how many people could move their vote between two parties or might not vote, might vote. So how many of you are not? I absolutely know what I'm going to do. In the European elections, in local elections, and the next general election, how many of you might vote for not the same party? Those three. There we go. Okay. Now you might be dead sure, locally I do this, nationally I do that. But you can change your mind from walking into the polling station up until the point you put the cross on the box. The reason we do an exit poll is to capture people within 6 seconds of having done it, so they haven't forgotten what they did. And I never, my mum used to drive people, you know, this is, my mum was Labour, as I told you. And in Labour, you always had to drive round because lots of people didn't have cars. And she drove one old lady to the polling station, and she managed to get all the way to vote. And then she shouted back to my mum, "Who am I supposed to vote for, dear?" Anyway, if you can't remember that, go on.
At the end of your talk, I think you said that a reason for optimism was more people would vote in the European elections. Yeah. I'm not sure that's my impression. I think that people are so disenchanted with the Brexit process that they've given up patience with democracy and that they're less likely to vote. So what's the reason for your optimism?
Well, we're going to find out. That might be the last question. We're going to find out very soon if they are held. My reason for optimism, it's not just optimism, the turnout in European elections is normally so low that actually going lower would be utterly stunning. And the young don't normally vote. And we've done a really, really good job of getting the young out of bed. The young went into bed in 1992 because we introduced the poll tax in 91. That's a tax that incentivizes you not to go on the electoral roll. Young stopped voting in 92, haven't voted since, came back, voted last general election. Once you vote once, it's addictive, you vote again. I think the young will vote in European elections, and people with an EU but not a UK passport. I'm hoping it's well over 50%, but we're going to find out. That's the great thing about that. But we don't know. Thank you ever so much for your patience. If you've got £8, there are 8 copies of the book. I do have £2 change. And do remember, I've got these leaflets. It is half price if you take a leaflet, if you want to know what it's like to work in a tantric massage parlour. Thank you ever so much.